fade down and we will get going here. Hour number two. There's a lot going on. We could do 2 hours easily tonight just on the information at hand. There is something coming up that we're going to cover. We're going to cover this Monday, and I hope you all can be sure to be here. There has been a decision made that awareness of shedding has become a bit of an issue, and they're going to try, to make the issue of shedding go away by flatly stating over and over again that it doesn't exist, it doesn't happen. Now, some of you who are regulars here will just laugh at that. Well, wait till you hear what happens Monday. We have a lot to cover tonight. Are you there, partner?
I am, Jeff.
All right. Yes.
Trying to stay warm up here.
Erica's in the New England area, and the coldest air mass on the planet is sitting right on top of you.
Currently -5, and the wind is whipping and feels like -22, I guess. I mean, all of a sudden, I mean, we've had a pretty mild winter so far. Not much snow, at least in this area, and not very cold at all, but boy, it is cold tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Now, there was Let me switch gears here. We're going to start out with someone you remember from a while back. Her name was Poornima Wag. P-O-O-R-N-I-M-A, Poornima. I call her Poormina. But Poormina Wag, W-A-G-H, is listed as a Ph.D., and she showed up and began to spew a lot of idiocy. And then she disappeared. Well, Poormina is back, and she's polished now. She's not stumbling around tossing word salads. She's really making some very strong, very stringent statements about things that you all know and we all know aren't right. They're completely wrong. And we're going to play a little sound clip of that. And our special guest tonight is back, Nurse Ann. And I can't wait to hear from her as well. But we've got to cover this Poormina thing. Go ahead and set this up for us, what we're going to hear.
Yeah, well, like Jeff was saying, she's now reappeared. If you remember, was it about 6 months ago, back in August
about,
or so?
About
she
that.
Was pretty much run off every platform because the information she was putting out was very easily debunked, and she was discredited. Her credentials didn't pan out, and she very quickly vaporized. But now she's back,
She's already appearing on. I think she's going to run the circuit of the platforms, the green screeners, and on up from there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But the gist of her message, if you can get through the preliminaries, which go on for a good hour or so of her presentation, the gist is that there is no virus, there is no spike protein, and there is nothing toxic being shed.
Yeah, we're going to get into this in depth Monday. We'll let you hear it right from Poormina herself. It's a stunner. So we're going to start off here with a little sound clip, honest, maybe 4 minutes, maybe five, and we want you to pay attention because this apparently is a harbinger of what's to come. This is the party line, and maybe they don't like us spending so much time explaining shedding and how it works with example after example after example, because there's obviously a decision made somewhere to debunk shedding entirely. That's the plan. But first up, let's take a listen to Poormina, and we'll comment on that as we continue with her. Do you remember what the gist of this was? She does get into the Brian Artis snake venom idiocy, which is interesting because she does a pretty good job of putting that down. And what else does she do?
Well, she talks extensively about how many vials that she and her team of scientists have analyzed, and that they were full of various undesirable things, contaminants, heavy metals, that type of thing. It was extensive.
I can tell you, though, I listened to the rest of it, just for FYI, she did not go to graphene oxide. That was not mentioned at all.
I think this is a different tact. I think she has selected Dr. Brian Artist, to expose or discredit in order to gain the trust and confidence of the listening audience. And then later on, she will present her side of things.
Right. Okay, here we go with poor Mina in a very recent appearance, in fact, February the 3rd, on the Regis Tremblay program. Let's see. Here we go.
Yes, I think this is very important because I actually get private emails from individuals asking me about the spike protein. Where's the spike protein? Is the spike protein infective? What does it do, et cetera? So in my first PowerPoint, I mentioned there was no SARS-CoV-2 virus. The SARS-CoV-2 virus is supposedly the virus that causes COVID-19. Well,
okay, there's number one. There is no SARS-CoV-2 virus. No, it's not there. Doesn't exist. All right, here we go.
Proved that it doesn't exist because it was never isolated, purified, or characterized, and no causation studies were done through Koch's postulate. So there's no SARS-CoV-2 virus. Now, there's no virus. There's also no spike protein because the spike protein was put into the genome of the entire fictitious virus. So the 30 to 40,000 base pairs of the fictitious viral genome had these little breaks, and where they put these little breaks, they had the spike protein put in there. So
there is no spike protein, Erica.
Right. Even though we can tag it and we can find it in the tissues of those who have been affected.
In every organ of the body?
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, autopsies, right?
Yeah.
We found them everywhere, literally all over the skin, literally everywhere, but there are none. Okay.
It doesn't exist, folks. It's just on the computer. So just to let you know, that's what happened. And like I said, the viral genome was a fictitious genome that was computer generated. It's called in silico genome. It was cobbled up by fusing together several other genomes from other viruses that were also made on the computer, like HIV, SARS-CoV-1, MERS, etc. So all these viruses are fictitious and they were made on the computer. The last point I want to make here is the PCR test was put together by German scientists Christian Drosten and Victor Korman, and it was programmed with human RNA from patient zero in Wuhan, China. I don't know if I mentioned this in my last episode on the PCRs. So hence the 97% false positive rate on the PCR is because people are testing positive because they're human. I mean, if you have human RNA, it's going to show up on the test because the test has been programmed with human RNA. What they picked up from the patient zero in Wuhan, China, was human RNA. It was not viral RNA. They have never, ever found any virus. So this is what's important. The other reason there's massive amounts of false positives in the PCRs is the number of threshold cycles. So the spinning, when you do the spinning in the centrifuge, they're doing it at 50 cycles, which is very high. The maximum amount of threshold cycles should be 25 to 30. You can't be going over 30 because then you show up as positive. The other thing that I need to mention, which is very important, is if you're sick, if anybody's sick, your cells throw out RNA and DNA because they're detoxifying. And when the RNA gets thrown out, it tests positive on the PCR because, like I said, the PCR is programmed with a 45 to 50 base pair human RNA strand on it. So
You notice how she never mentioned Dr. Kerry Mullis, the inventor of the PCR? She talked about two people who allegedly put the test together, and they went on to underscore her statement that there are no viruses. Okay, I hope all of you caught this, because this is going to be the next effort to confuse and to infuse chaos into the understanding of what we're trying to put out there. So here we go. Back to it. That was just a, you know, that, oh, hold on. I wish we could play this again. We can't. We don't have time. Here we go.
Please be aware that the PCRs are bogus and fake. Then we have, this is the one that I think needs to be looked at. I know, Regis, you brought this up. The snake venom. Is it something to worry about? Is it snake venom? Okay, if it's not a virus, is it snake venom?
All right, now she's talking about Dr. Brian Artis, the chiropractor, who was the one who promulgated, put forth the ridiculous, ludicrous idea that there was king cobra snake venom in your tap water, okay? And that's what was killing people and making them sick. So here she goes. This is going to earn her respect in the minds of some who are watching and listening. And it's being done to give her some, what they call, street credentials, okay? Here we go.
So there is really no way that snake venom can be put into the vaccine. There's no way they can put snake venom and aerosolize it from the planes or let it out anywhere, you know, in the air. It's not possible. Now, the person who talked about this, I'm not going to name this person. He's a chiropractor in the United States, but he made a lot of money by doing the snake venom nonsense and selling a lot of products on his website. And this is why we have the snake venom nonsense going around, and people are, you know, it's a new form of fear mongering, and people are getting scared. And I've given you two links there. One is called viralig.com, and the other one is by Dr. Tom Cowan, an interview, a webinar between Dr. Tom Cowan and biotechnologist and scientist Mike Donio, who go into absolute detail. I mean, there's so much detail in there about why snake venom is not possible, that it's not snake venom causing COVID-19 symptoms. One of the reasons is snake venom is very expensive. And this person who was throwing the snake venom fallacy out there was saying that it was snake venom from these banded crates and cobras that are only found in Asia, pretty much in China. And the amino acids or the peptides that were used were put into the water. Then he retracted that, because you can't put something into the water. It's just going to get diluted. And it's very expensive to import these things and put it into the water supply. So again, this is logic 101. You can't do this stuff. The other thing he said was mRNA with the snake venom was put into the water supply. That's not possible either, because mRNA is a protein. And every time the protein gets exposed to air or water or anything like that outside the human body, it immediately, within nanoseconds, it decomposes.
Oh, really?
Well,
oh, really?
It's not a protein. It's a nucleotide. And yes, it is very delicate outside of the body. It would degrade.
But she didn't have her labels right. Now, she just earned a lot of confidence in people, because her criticism of this snake venom scam, which is what it was, is correct. That was done properly and with reason. So it's how you earn people's confidence. There's a perfect example of it.
So no, there's no snake venom.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there's partial truths in the snake venom, I don't even know what to call it, a theory. Because, you know, there are sequences in the spike protein that are a match for venom. So it isn't the venom itself, but the peptides can induce those same effects. So it's a partial truth. And that has been looked at for a number of years, years ago, I think I pulled up a paper from 1977 where they were looking at inserting sequences of venomous, I think it was snakes, it could have been snails, into a spike on a coronavirus. So that is possible, and it appears they have succeeded in doing that in designing this spike so that it does have some features of what venom does.
Hold on. Here we go.
Anywhere in our system, it's not in the vaccines or the injections, and it's not in the air, so please don't be afraid.
So, Pornima.
Okay. That's all we're going to run tonight from Pormina. We're going to go into it in more detail on Monday, where she completely tries to annihilate the concept that shedding can occur and does occur. Very interesting. All right. Anything you want to add to that?
No. This is going to be very interesting to watch. I think this is the next act in the circus.
Right. The never-ending carnival.
Yeah.
All right. Let's bring our special guest on now, Nurse Anne, and hopefully she's there. Are you there, Anne?
Yes, I am. How are you, Jeff and Erica?
Hi, Anne.
We're okay.
How are you?
Is it cold there?
Freezing. Absolutely
yeah.
Freezing.
It's so cold we hear the sound of a barking dog.
I had to go and put extra hay in for my hens because I was worried about the frigid conditions that it might actually kill them.
It's that cold.
We're down to like one degree right now. So,
yeah
it's pretty cold here.
Mm-hmm.
Bring them into
Aren't
the bedroom.
Lucky?
Well, hey, listen, I was tempted. somebody wouldn't like that. They make
right,
a lot of
now,
noise in the morning when they lay their eggs.
Yeah.
And
Nurse
that,
Anne
that cold
is,
us right now, Jeff.
Yeah, that's too cold. For you newcomers, Nurse Anne has been with us many times. She is a professional registered nurse and then some. She's extraordinary. She's got well over 35 years experience, and she's still 27 years old. Beside that, she's a wonderful human being and gives us inside looks at what's going on in the big hospital. She's currently working at a 600-bed approximately hospital in New York and the area there. And what's been going on since we last talked? Tell us your view.
Well, we're still seeing a high influx of patients coming in for chest pain, chest tightness, new onset AFib, and the population is getting younger. I actually took care of a 26-year-old kid last night. I'll lead in with this story. And he had gone back to college, and because he had gone back to college, the college was requiring him to get vaccinated. So he went and he had the first two, and then he had the booster, and a week later, he's here in our hospital, and we're now taking care of him.
So when did he take the first two? When did he take the I didn't know they were still giving the first two. I thought they were just giving the booster. When did he start the series, approximately?
No, he took the first two in 2020, and he didn't take anything after that.
Okay, I see.
And then he decided he wanted to go back to college, and the college said, yeah, we'll gladly take you and your money, but you're going to have to take a vaccine first. So he went and he took the booster 10 days ago.
And so did he have a heart attack or what?
So he came in with complaining of chest pain, chest tightness. He was in new onset AFib. Then they started to do, he had abdominal pain. That was the other thing that he had. And then he had back pain. And then he had pain that went all the way down to his testicles.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So anyway, they worked him up. He's a young, fit, skinny guy, athletic, and has never been sick a day in his life, first time ever in the hospital.
Wow.
And he so he said that he does weights. He worked out at the gym 6 days a week, and all of a sudden this happened. And so initially when he went to his primary care physician, the primary care physician was saying, oh, it's probably just stress. You're in school now. You're probably stressed out. So he blew it off. And the kid waited another 2 days until the point where he couldn't wait any longer. He was in such pain, and he couldn't breathe, and he was struggling to just catch his breath, and he ended up in our hospital. So he is in
Taking the bivalent booster, he was just wiped out. He couldn't function.
Totally wiped out. Yep.
So do they have a diagnosis, or how are they treating it?
Right now they're treating it as new onset AFib, but the I only had him last night. Cardiology is going to be coming in, and they're going to actually be looking into greater, doing more diagnostics to see if there's any other underlining problem. There's already speculation in the notes that that he might have myocarditis. But they're not sure yet, and they can't explain why.
It seems like at a minimum, that would be a minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I said the same thing. But the problem with throwing them all off is they can't explain why he's having all that pain in his abdomen, going down his in his back, going down to his testicles. They cannot. For the life of them, they don't know what's going on there. But they did a CAT scan off the abdomen and the pelvis, and the preliminary report that came back said suspicious of a thrombus. Now, that's a clot. I'm not going to say blood clot, but it's some form of a clot.
Right.
So anyway, they cardiology has yet to see him, and then they want vascular to see him as well, which was. I would have seen a lot of the vascular cardiac surgeons when I worked in the last year and in the on the job that I was doing last year. There's most definitely a clot there, but there's probably something even more serious than that.
And it sounds like he may be in critical condition. Soon.
Yeah. It could be. This is the kind of case that could turn really bad really quickly. And the other thing is criminal. Again, criminal acts have been done on the poor people. That physician, when he presented with chest pain, that's an absolute, you need to go to the hospital. You got to get that checked out. Chest pain is the number one killer and any kind of respiratory. You've got to get that stuff checked out, because if you're truly having any form of heart attack or an infarction, your muscle is dying by the minute. So, and the thing about the heart muscle is it doesn't regenerate. So, this is a 26-year-old kid. So he went days after presenting to his primary care physician with this. So. And the amount of damage that could be done to this kid is yet to be found out.
Well, I'm thinking because of the delay, because of the first doctor, he could be dead. He could have died.
He could have died. Yeah, that kid could have died. It's incredible that he was actually still doing so well when he got to our hospital. But.
Right.
He's not actually, like, he's still not out of the woods. And there's still a lot of unknowns. And he's probably facing at least multiple surgeries at this point. And this
he's
is
probably facing multiple surgeries already at this point. This is 10 days after taking that damned bivalent booster. And this kid's life is now It'll never be the same. It's ruined.
Surgeries for removing clots, do you think, or?
Yeah. I suspect he's at least looking at the removal of clots, and then whatever they find out on between the echo, they were supposed to be doing an MRI, and a nuclear stress test. And all of those tests are going to be very telling. Now, I'm not working for the next couple of days, so I don't know how this is going to go. But they actually have cardiology was coming in to see him today to talk about what they were going to do. But I could tell based on the notes they had, like, the plan of action so far was to do this.
That would be really fast for him to generate a clot. We'll say it's an amyloid clot just because that's what we usually see. That's awfully fast after that injection. One wonders if maybe the first two shots he got in 2020 have been slowly building these things in the background, and he was never aware of them. He gets the booster, and all of a sudden, it's like a jet engine gets turned on. It just goes. I don't know. That seems very quick, though.
Yeah, and the other thing is the concern is with the pain that's radiating from his back and his abdomen down to his testicles. That's not how you usually present with, you know, like a true cardiac issue. So it seems like he has multiple issues going on. Mm-hmm. He has two separate issues going on at the same time. And this is all because of one event.
Okay, the general population in the hospital right now, people like this young man. You say that patients are younger and younger all the time. Are you to the point in the hospital where you're essentially full at this point and beginning to convert other wards into just, we'll call them spike victims, whatever? What are you seeing stacked up?
I actually was able to go on and look at the screen that the charge nurse sees on the unit for how many people are waiting to come up to the medical observation unit. And
right.
So I can see what patients are in the ER and how many are there. So last night I took a look just to see, because she had the screen open. Wasn't that convenient? And
yes.
So I went and I took a look. So in the ER, there was our ER, one hospital, there was 111 patients in that one ER. Out of the 111, there were 7 peds in the ER.
Now that means pediatrics.
Pediatrics, yes. Mm. And there was 75 adults admitted to the hospital waiting on a bed. Out of the 111 patients.
111 in the ER, stacked in the halls, up and down, sitting,
all over,
waiting.
Yeah.
And then 75 of them were admitted and put in beds.
Put in beds.
That's
waiting for a bed to go to an actual unit.
Got it. Wow. They had out here, Anne, there was a woman, a friend of a friend of mine, 61-year-old woman, went in. She had gotten shot up, and she went in and had cancer in the past. And ever since getting the booster, I guess the cancer was turned loose. So she was in the hospital, and they worked her up and told her, well, you have metastatic malignant melanoma all over. You might have about 90 days, 3 months. Now, would you please go home and free this bed up? We need it. Here.
Yep.
You're
tying up a bed.
Yes. They said, go home and die. We need this bed.
They're actually basically writing orders in the emergency room now to follow up with palliative care hospice. But that's that, rather than even treat.
Wow. Okay,
with all the level of acuity, it's horrendous.
Give us a little more. Yeah, and give us a little more on that. What somebody comes into ER, tell us how that write-up and a recommendation to go right to hospice is done. How would that happen? Give us an example. Somebody comes in with chest pain. Somebody comes in with migraines that won't quit. Whatever.
Right. Well, once they do the workup and they usually find a mass, they usually basically say, well, they'll find out from the patients how they want to go about it. And they'll say, well, you need to follow up with an oncologist, do some aggressive blood work, and depending on how you want to go on along with your treatment, if you want to go and do chemo or radiation, they will say you may have to do these things. That's up to the oncologist because they're emergency doctors. But they're just saying, really, that is something that wouldn't be viewed as been treated in the emergency room. So I recommend that you follow up with your primary care physician. If you're in acute pain, they will hold you till your pain is addressed. And if they hold you in the ER while they're treating your pain, you're sitting on an ER gurney or in a big armchair. They call them jerry chairs. Some people don't even get the stretchers now. It's just wall-to-wall people. Or they're even in wheelchairs. They're even in wheelchairs waiting now. And so they say, okay, we're going to treat your pain and probably do some of the diagnostics, but ultimately you'll have to follow up with the oncologist follow up with your oncologist. And some people will end up leaving. People who are in pain will stay. They'll be put in a holding area. And then there's a bunch of nurses that are assigned to those holding areas, and they're treated now like units. It's almost like as if you were in the middle of a war and you have set up a medic camp, and you're now just treating the most sickest of the sick, the people who are hurt, the people who've lost limbs, the people who have... That's what it's like. It's literally like as if you're in a war-like zone. I would not wish to be an emergency nurse at any point in time in my life, and certainly not right now. And they have lost tons and tons of ER nurses because of how medicine has just taken such a horrendous turn in how we're treating patients.
It sounds like when people walk in the door, it's immediate triage for them.
Yeah.
They're evaluated on the basis of, are they going to die in the next 5 minutes or might they live another week or two, whatever. But if they come in there and they find a mass, they say, well, we're going to refer you back to your oncologist. And then you have to deal with the backup at the oncology department, wherever that is. Your oncology doctors are, I'm sure, overloaded. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is they will probably admit you, but you'll sit in the ER for days. Like there was, so this person I'm going to talk about. This is a classic example of that case. He was a 74-year-old. He had a history of a hiatal hernia and asthma, and that was all he ever had. He didn't have anything else going on with him in his lifetime. Huh. So he presented with intractable nausea and vomiting, and he couldn't swallow anything. He was having dinner. All of a sudden, he couldn't swallow anything. He started just having this horrendous pain in his chest because he felt like something got stuck in his chest. So he ended up in the emergency room. So, of course, initially they work him up for what might possibly be a cardiac event. Well, it's not actually a cardiac event. He's having huge abdominal pain. So they send him down for a CT of the abdomen and the pelvis, and it shows a kidney mass. And in the report, it actually says very suspicious of cancer. So
the kidneys. What was his shot history? Do you know how soon?
Fully vaccinated, and very proud of it.
So it's five shots.
And this is what killed me. This story is the worst. This killed me the most. he's telling me about how he had gotten vaccinated, and he knew he was due for another booster. Now he was already at booster number 4. So he's telling me this, and he's very proud of the fact that he had taken care of himself and got all these shots. And now I had come to find out that they had found this renal mass on his CT, and he was going for an MRI that night to basically confirm it. But and then they're going to do biopsies as well, but they're very suspicious of it. So anyway, I knew this going in, and he's telling me he goes, I have a good friend. Every Saturday I spend playing cards with him. We play poker. And I joke, and he said, and of course you let him win, right? And he goes, no, he wouldn't think I'm a good friend if I let him win. No, it's pure competition between us men. And he goes, well, every Saturday, because he's dealing with cancer, and he this is the only thing that gets in mind off all his worries. Well, I knew right there and then he had had cancer. The patient had not been told yet that he has cancer. Can you imagine being in that room? I just was like, oh, my God, when will it stop? And so that was like the hardest thing for me to hear, that when he's telling me this story. He's married with a wife. He was one of 7 kids. And he has no idea. He has no idea what's ahead of him.
Boy.
Well, not much is ahead of him except a lot of pain and misery. This biological weapon kills with no mercy. It is awful. And you've seen it more closely than anyone mm-hmm. I'll ever know. These people are suffering. They're in agony, many of them. And remember, everyone who has substantial myocarditis, for example, often has constant chest pain. It hurts. Their heart hurts. Can you imagine living with that, friends? Pain? Your heart hurts? No. And that's just one of dozens of different things that this bioweapon can cause in the body. The spike protein is ruthless. Horrible.
The other thing I took a look at in his chart was interesting was, besides all the other labs being wacky-doodle, the one thing that stood out was his vitamin D was 14. I mean, it was completely in the toilet. His vitamin D was wiped out.
Mm.
So that's one of the risk factors. Yeah. And now the other issue with him, he had huge issues with high blood pressure. Like his blood pressure was 184 or over 84. I mean, I was chasing it all night long trying to. I mean, it was so high, and I thought, oh my God, this poor man. And he has yet to be told that he has this renal mass that's cancerous, and his blood pressure is through the roof. Is he going to stroke out of me first? You know, with his blood pressure. And all night long, I was chasing doctors to try and bring this blood pressure down. It was insane. It was absolutely insane. Just how nonchalant was the word I'd use about it. And I was there, you know, can we try this? Could we do this? Could we give him this? No, let's just see. Let's just watch it.
Wow.
Boy. How old?
74.
Okay.
And he was, the other thing about this man was, he was alert. He was oriented. He had lived. He was living a very great, very great life. He was a hunter. He loved fishing. He was a chatty catty. He loved to talk, but he was a really nice guy. And you know, when he came into that hospital, he had no idea that I'm going to tell you. He has no idea about what they're about to tell this poor man. It's going to shatter his world when he hears this.
This happens every day, all day, 24 hours a day, to countless millions of people to date. 2 years of this horror, and it's not going to stop. It's going to get worse. What about staffing? Now, Nurse Anne is in a And you're in an observation, and observation mode, is that the group?
Yeah.
Observation unit?
And it's
so
kind of like
people...
we tag team the emergency room. So what happens is when the emergency room has patients that the doctors deem that they want to admit or at least observe to decide whether they should send them home or not, because they will actually be dinged. This is the reason this is happening, by the way, the medical observation unit. They're going to get hit by the insurance companies if they send the patient home too soon and the patient ends up coming back for the same problem again within 30 days. The hospital won't get no payment from the insurance companies. That's just on the no, okay? Medicare will not pay out for if a patient ends up going in for the same diagnosis in under 30 days. So that's why they hold them. So they'll hold the patients that they're trying to figure out what's actually going on. If they can actually figure out what is actually going on, then they'll make that decision. Well, we can treat you or we can't. But most of them are staying. And they'll set up all of these camps. So that's a big deciding factor for how they do it with patients, managing the patient's acuity levels and how they present. With staffing, then, they have to have a lot of emergency room nurses. But the emergency room nurses will end up working as like a unit nurse. Like she's on a regular floor, because she'll be put in these things, like these little medics sections of the emergency room. And she'll probably have anywhere from 5 to 6 patients. And then there'll be another emergency room nurse. And so my unit, we'll take the lesser of the acuity, supposedly, that the ED can't handle. And they'll send them up to us. But so many times they're really, really deathly sick, and they shouldn't even be on my unit. They should be either in a higher level of care where they're getting monitored 24/7. So anyway, that's how they're handling it. It's a solution to a very difficult problem.
3-4 years ago, people who would come into the ER were coming in for flu, broken bones, auto wrecks, all kinds of things. Now it seems to me that the majority of people who come into the ER are coming in there as victims of the bioweapon injection. They have been damaged severely. That's what it sounds like.
I would agree. I'd agree that a lot of them are coming in. And, you know, I will say, go back to the beginning of when it all started, when we didn't know what was going on and COVID started, and people were getting very sick back then. They were getting sick from the flu, and we were treating them for this supposedly COVID and medicating them with our remdesivir. And that's why we're having such a sick population. Now, fast forward to what we're seeing now, and you're seeing this situation where they're coming in. They might very well have got the first, the Janssen vaccine. That was just one shot. Or they might have got Moderna, which was 2 at the time, or the Pfizer, which was 2 at the time. And they may not have never gone to the hospital. To 2 or 3 years later, and then they're deciding to go and get these boosters. It's when the boosters started happening, we started seeing a huge influx in patients coming to the emergency room. And now they're sicker than they've ever been. They were probably never sick before. And it's always classically, you just have to follow the trail of when the booster was given. That's when you'll start seeing them. It can be anywhere from the day off all the way right to like 30 days after. But it's actually not even 30. It's less than that. It's a lot less than that. So they're coming in and they're presenting with the class. They're either a couple of things with the old people. They're falling and they don't know why they're falling. They're passing out. That's typical. That's what happens. That's how they end up in the emergency room. Once you put them on the monitor, you'll start seeing arrhythmias that they never had before, which I was saying about the AFib. AFib is treacherous. This is one arrhythmia that should never have been taken lightly. And the only way to treat it is typically they'll put you on anticoagulations or they'll try and do an ablation. Well, there was a lady who had two ablations done. And then she went and got the boosters. And now she's back again in AFib. And you know, it's incredible to me. And not only that, they're increasing the dosages, I've noticed, of the anticoagulation. Specifically, I'm talking about Eliquis. That used to be a 5-milligram tablet that they would put you on when you would go home. They're increasing that dosage to 10 now. So
is it doing anything?
Something. Nothing, because they're still coming back, presenting with the same similar issues.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's not an anticoagulation problem. What's happening is it's just making them bleed and bruise more. But
right.
That will happen when you start messing with that, and when they fall, they're more likely, if they hit their head, they're definitely more likely to have a bleed.
Mm-hmm.
But the injuries can be very severe because of the potential for bleeding.
Right.
So, and that's with the little old people, but the ages are all over the map. There was, as I said yesterday, there was 7 children in the ER. The ages ranged from anywhere from, I believe I was from, let's see, 2 to 99. I had a 99-year-old last night who came to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And the children. Go ahead, Erica. Go
ahead. I was just going to ask, are people dying while waiting to be seen or be admitted?
We've had a few codes in the emergency room, but those patients were basically on death's door when they arrived via EMS anyway. And
okay.
They had coded on route two. And so they had
okay.
coded in the emergency room. There was a few kids who coded in the emergency room.
Kids?
Kids, yeah. They stopped breathing.
See, and all these kids, am I right? All these kids have loving parents who gave them the shot.
Yeah. The kids were vaccinated, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they didn't go out on their own at 2 years of age and decide to get their own shot. These parents did it. And I don't blame the parents. The parents don't know any better. They've been lied to and conned. This whole thing is an incredible psychological operation driven by fear. Protect my kids. I got to get them. Yeah, I got to get them the vax. And these kids are just going out. Young women are being, they're out of the breeding pool now. The men are being taken out of the breeding pool as well. Prostate issues, endometrial issues. They must be doing hysterectomies right and left all the time now.
Go ahead, Ian.
No, I think that it's affecting the men as well. You see a lot of young men coming in and they're complaining of a lot of pain and difficulty mm-hmm. urinating and stuff like that. And I think it's affecting the men similar to how it's affecting the women.
I'll bet you got prostate cancers more than you can count here this year. It's just going to be everywhere. That's my sense.
I haven't seen a trend on it yet, but mm-hmm. I'd keep an eye out, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Erica. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, with regard to the endometrial thing, you know, we've known from the beginning of 2021. Yeah, that there was an uptick in the rates of that particular type of cancer. And now you can actually find a support group for young women with endometrial cancer that is, I'm guessing there's 3,000 in this one particular group. And these are women in their 20s in some cases.
Yes.
Just having hysterectomy, and, you know, whether they're vaxxed or not, you know, that's not talked about because, well, you can't. But that's a highly unusual cancer for a young woman to have.
Yeah.
So what has changed recently?
Yeah, it is, and there is a lot of cases coming in that they're working them up, and they're potentially seeing cancer cases. Mm. The other issues are the cardiac, the chest pain people.
And are women coming
again,
in?
That's across the board.
Women coming in bleeding a lot too? Like, we've had reports of women bleeding for months on end, nonstop.
Yeah, they're reporting it never stops. Speaking of bleeding, I'm glad you mentioned that. One of the things I did see that's trending now again, because they weren't doing it for the longest time, is now they're doing D-dimers again on all of our chest painters for sure. Oh, yeah. And they are through the roof. Take the roof off the house. The roof. In the thousands. The D-dimers are in the thousands.
And they're coming back positive.
Positive. Yeah.
I had
a 28-year-old with a chest pain, and she, her troponins were negative, but she had like a 5,000 or 6,000 D dimer, and then they showed that she had a complete collapse of her right upper lobe, and they were going to treat her as an asthmatic case, and they were going to put her on breathing treatments and steroids, and then depending on how she, they think she had some sort of like a mucus plug. Now tell me, how does this healthy 28-year-old have all these issues? But she doesn't have a history of asthma, because I asked her. I said, well, do you have a history of any kind of cardiac pain issues or any? No, never. This is all
I don't know how you do it, Anne. What you're watching, mass murder, is what you're watching. And you know it. And I'm sure some of the other people are working on. Last quick question. We're over time here. How much longer can these hospitals function before they begin to fall apart and close or at least limit services? They're being overwhelmed. How much longer before
I think they're already falling apart, Jeff. They're already falling. They don't have the staff. And the hospital I'm in is probably going to be going out on strike. There's a word about it that they may be going out on strike. So, and then I will say one proud event is that I can safely say is I opened up the world of how we were lied to three different nurses on the three different nights I worked. I brought in the Robert Kennedy book, the real Anthony Fauci, and I brought in another book by Dr. Coleman, and I had them look at certain pages in the book, and I said, now how do you feel about the vaccine? Well, a lot of these girls were forced to take it because they were the only person working, and they were the head of the household, so that's why they took it. But and then I remember talking to one nurse, and she had a baby, and she read the page from Dr. Coleman's book. And she said to me, am I going to die? And I didn't know how to answer that question. I said to her, listen, it's been a while since you had the vaccines. You had them back in 2021. Hopefully, you got the placebo. Maybe you were lucky.
All right. Well, Anne, we've got to run. We're running late. Thank you very much for being here and helping us get a look inside the world of mass death and agony and injury in the hospitals. It's really something else. Thank you. You take care of yourself.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you,
bye-bye
Anna.
Now.
Okay, stay warm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's getting worse and worse, as we knew. And this is going to be a hell of a ruthless year for a lot of people.
Well, especially if that hospital goes on strike, probably won't be the only one.
No, I wouldn't think. Okay, we got to run. Good job, as always. Talk soon.
Okay.
Take care. Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. Good night, everyone. Have a good weekend.
All right, we'll be right back with Hour 3 in just a few minutes. Hold on.